We'll call to order the House Revenue Committee meeting this morning and welcome everybody here. Thank you for being on time for our 8 o'clock start today. Appreciate everyone's attentiveness to that. We have the bills on the schedule that are before us. We'll start right at the top of the order with HJR 30, a public hearing on that. Madison, if you could give us a brief overview, and then we'll bring up Representative Dingfelder, who is co-sponsor of the bill, and have her chief sponsor of the bill, and have her lead in the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 30 introduces a new taxing system, property taxing system, and it is named the site value taxation system. It hinges on the idea of taxing land at a different rate than taxing other property. There's a dash one amendment. I think it's a new packet. And I will go through the changes from the dash one amendment as we go. It's important to bring to your attention again that in the constitutional language, Article 11 of the Constitution, Section 11, Article 11, Section 11 is where Measure 5 and Measure 50 actually operate into the language in order to make the taxing system or the taxation system a rate-based, permanent rates and so on, and capped by Measure 5 limits. This measure of the House Joint Resolution 30 introduces a new subsection K of Section 11 of Article 11 of the Constitution. And this subsection K would have the site value taxation, started giving it the name SVT for now. And it introduces this as an alternative in a way, but not as an alternative to substitute, but as an alternative as a choice. So it will be a second choice open for local districts if they choose to switch the taxing or the taxation system from the the permanent rate type idea with Measure 5, Measure 50 capped with $5 and $10 by Measure 5 into a tax that is based primarily on real market value, and that real market value it determines a new amount that are actually two different tax rates, one for land and one for other property. In the original bill, the suggestion was that it will be a variable tax rate for land and a fixed tax rate for other property. The dash one amendment takes that out and leaves both as uniform tax rates. But the land is always higher than the property rate. That's one way of implementing the tax. A second way open to implement the tax, if it is adopted by the district's voters, a second way would be to have a fixed ratio between the two tax rates, between the land and the other property taxes, so that fixed ratio keeps moving up and down based on where the tax goes. These rates are not bounded by the Measure 5 limits, so they're exempted from the Measure 5 limits, which means they could go above and beyond those limits. And it leaves a mechanism for transitioning or phasing in the new SVT or the site value tax system over the period of 5 years. This 5 years, however, the one condition is at no time the tax rate for the land will be lower than the tax rate for other property. naturally with introducing a second choice that districts could switch to, they have to switch to this exclusively. So they either are on the old system, the 11B, if you will, subsection or 11B, or this new SVT system. It's either or, it becomes. Because of that introduction, there needs and there is in this joint resolution a requirement to exempt this taxation system from the uniformity of taxation articles in the Constitution. And that is what the final sections of the paragraph 2 of the joint resolution does. In the sense that it is a House joint resolution at this point, and that it opens a new way or a new option, or a new local option, if you will, it in itself does not have a revenue impact unless and until it is approved and implementing legislation occurs, because it will need that implementing legislation. However, the fiscal impact of how much the costs would be for the elections and so on have not been fine-tuned yet.
All right. Did you have a question?
I do. Can maybe you explain to me how that works in urban renewal districts?
Good.
second.
You want to start with that?
I do.
Oh, Representative Dingfeld there, looks like she is.
I'm not going to answer that question, but we have...
Come on down. You're the first one up anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Shetterly and members of the Revenue Committee, for the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative for House District 45. And, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask the committee if... because on the first blush, it's very confusing to explain, and we're going to have some people up here who I think will do a great job at trying to explain this. So I might ask if you can just hold off on questions until I get my certified smart people up here who are behind me.
You okay with that?
I thought I explained it perfectly.
Well, you must have, because that's why she wanted to go right to the nitty-gritty. Okay, I get it. Now tell me about how it relates to urban renewal.
Well, thank you for consideration of this measure, and I particularly want to thank Representative Shetterly for co-sponsoring this bill with me. The proposal before you, land value taxation, is not an easy one to fully understand at first blush, as I mentioned, which is why I've invited these folks behind me, certified smart people, to come up and give you a full explanation and hopefully answer all your questions. But I will, and they'll provide a much more in-depth explanation than I will, but you will see that this idea enjoys a broad array of support from representatives from academia, business, planning, and property development. Land value taxation is not a new idea. Numerous cities and regions, both in the United States and abroad, have adopted this model of property taxation as a mechanism to encourage economic development in targeted areas and to reduce the use of idle buildings. Where employed, land value taxation has brought market improvements in property values and overall economic conditions of the affected areas. However, it is an option that is not currently available to planners and policymakers at the city, county, and the regional level because of our property tax codes that are part of Oregon's constitution. Briefly, this measure is not a tax increase. I will emphasize not a tax increase, but a shift in the tax base of the property tax. Instead of falling equally on both buildings and land, the tax would fall on the value of the location. And wherever a jurisdiction has shifted its property tax, business has benefited. I'd also like to note that this proposal fits well with our existing land use system, which Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder will discuss later. Adoption of this concept would require the approval of the citizens of Oregon, as you've already heard, which is why this measure has been written as a resolution. Due to the technical nature of the concept before you, I believe that it deserves a thorough discussion and examination before going out to the voters. With regards to helping spur economies at the local level, I believe that we ought to give local governments all the tools we can, and this option would be one such tool. With that, I would like to turn it over to those who can provide expert testimony and hopefully answer any questions you might have. However, before I do that, there are a number of individuals who could not make it here today to testify due to scheduling conflicts, and they've submitted written testimony, which the committee staff will be handing out to you. We've also included lots of handouts that I encourage you to review those materials, because hopefully that will also assist you in answering any questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have those materials? Do you want to pass those out now? Can't please begin. Okay. Is John Russell's letter included in the materials? Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Let's go. Mr. Representative Dingfelder, I've got J.J. Smith signed up. Was he on your team? Did you want to add him in a particular order?
Yeah, he'll be at the end.
At the end, okay. Then let's bring up next Chris Nelson, Rex Burkholder, and Tom Guerin. Start slow, gentlemen. And don't take us right away to urban renewal, even though we can't wait to get there.
Well, we actually hope that that's one of the more difficult questions, because we have a fairly straightforward answer for you on that one. For the record, I'm Chris Nelson, principal of Geonomics Consulting. I reside at 2125 Southeast Orange Avenue in Portland, 97214. Chair Shetterly and members of the Revenue Committee, I'm thrilled to be here today because I believe this could be a historic moment by considering a tax proposal that really could be considered an enterprise incentive. So that may appear to be an oxymoron, but we're here today to try and explain how that is not actually the case. As you may know, that the conventional property tax is actually composed of a tax on the land and a tax on the improvements. So as a 50-50 split, this is analogous to having a train with an engine on both ends. In fact, the mayor of Atlantic City, New Jersey, dubbed the conventional property tax the tax from hell. Why might have he called it this? Well, if we look at what the conventional property tax does by taxing improvements, it actually penalizes people, landlords, businesses, for improving their property. It acts as a disincentive for investment. It acts as a deadweight loss in economic terms, or a drag on our struggling economies. It acts as a disincentive for improving multifamily housing. It acts as a disincentive to improve your own home. So this actually comes at a huge cost to our economy. Economically, land value is actually created through society's activities as a whole. Our investments in schools, parks, roads, infrastructure, society's activities as a whole in a particular location along with population creates land value. So economists in general have a consensus that land value is created this way. But building value is created by the individual owner through investments in the structure or improvements on the site. So it follows naturally then that not taxing these privately generated values leaves it in private hands. And then on the flip side, if land value is actually created through society's activities as a whole, collecting the annual increase in land value puts publicly created value in public hands. So not taxing improvements as much as sites, we would not wage such a deadweight loss or economic disincentive. Because by taxing improvements, we incur heavy opportunity cost on the economy, because what we are doing instead is taxing things like investments, income, earnings, payroll, and potentially there's been proposals to tax sales, privately created value. So one of the most stable means of public finance is actually collecting the annual increase in land value. Look at what's happening today in this economically depressed times. Where are most of the investments going? They're going in real estate. Why are they primarily going into real estate? Because land holds stability in its value. So relying on land and less on improvements for the tax base taps the security and value. Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and about 18 other cities in Pennsylvania have demonstrated this stability in their tax base now for years. Pittsburgh has actually been taxing land higher for almost a century until about 2 years ago. So we have quite a bit of data. This is really not a brand new idea to show that this can actually build stability in our tax base. Building permit data from many Appalachian cities that have adopted this two-rate tax confirm that the enterprise incentive effect is there, is very measurable. And in fact, in at least the 3 years following the separation of the tax rates, building permits skyrocket, often doubling. It has the high, Pittsburgh itself has one of the highest owner occupancy rates in the country per capita, and is one of the lowest average home cost cities in the country. And I might also add, while it's only the 17th largest city in the country, it has, I think, about 200th ranking for crime. So the owner occupancy rate and crime statistics may actually have an association. This form of taxation is also one of the lowest costs to administer and collect. Because land cannot be hidden, we can't usually disguise it, unlike other forms of taxation, such as income, this is a very secure way to collect public finances. And also because land is assessed using computer-aided mass appraisal, also known as CAMA, in today's world, we have fewer disputes about what land values are. What does that lead to? That leads to fewer appeals and less litigation and less need for staff in county assessor's offices. So believe it or not, this is one tax that could very well actually shrink government, and data in these Pennsylvania cities that have adopted it has shown that. In many cases, assessor's offices have shrunk by 40%. So are there some weaknesses to a split-rate property tax? If you consider roughly on average the 5% of the residential sector who might qualify as hardship cases, well, yes, there are cases where people would need some assistance, and there are tried and true mechanisms to do that. We have deferments currently on our books. We can phase these in, these changes in over 5 years, and we could even add, while it's not in this proposal, a homestead exemption up to a certain level of valuation. So what about incidents? Who might pay more and who might pay less? Along with my colleague to my left, Tom Gehring, I am a co-author of a study done for Salem looking at the various splits of the property tax onto land and what sectors would pay more and pay less. And Tom will actually go into more detail about our study. But just briefly, I would just mention that the industrial and multifamily housing sectors would receive a substantial tax break. Downtown businesses and compact commercial areas would also likely see a tax decline. The average homeowner would pay less at land value tax levels below 80% under this proposal. Basically, building intensive uses, such as office buildings, would receive a tax reduction. So, simultaneous with these changes, developers, remodelers, realtors, mortgage companies, banks, architects, designers, and many landlords would likely experience more business. Why? Because when you reduce the disincentive to invest, that brings in more business. And lastly, I would like to end by saying this is an important economic development tool, as you've heard, that really should be available to all economic communities in this state. Can we really afford to continue not to use such an important economic development tool while we're trying to assist rural communities to help revive their local economies? So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Are there questions before we go to Mr. Buehring? Mr. Burkholder, I guess, is next.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
If everyone... I'm having a hard time... Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time following this... If everyone you mentioned pays less,
right. Who pays
more?
Was that just a tease? Mr. Gehring's testimony.
Well, the non-building intensive uses would likely pay more, and Tom can describe a little more. Yeah, the details of that. But generally, those areas that, such as downtown surface parking lots. You're likely to see, depending on the location, but if there's a large parking lot associated with, say, a big box retail, depending on their level of intensity of use, they would possibly pay more. But in Salem, 85% of the tax base is through the residential sector, so they drive the tax base here, and there would be, of course, some homeowners who would end up paying more if they have a small house on a very large lot, for example. But that difference would depend on the level of the split in the property tax. So if it goes above 80%, then it's likely that you'll see more people actually paying more, say about up to 5% more, but not significant.
Yeah. Also, in my experience, although you say land and improvements are taxed at a 50-50 ratio, I don't know that I find that to be true. I don't think that they're equally taxed.
Yeah.
The land is generally, well, it could be at a higher value or a lower value, but they're not at a 50-50 split.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm understanding the proposal, which I don't know that I am, but if I am, it puts a different value on the land based upon what the surroundings of the area would be, I suppose. But, well, it has to have some mechanism that values the land differently than what it currently is valued at, whether it be increase or decrease.
No, the valuation of the land would not change. The assessments would not be affected by this bill. It's just the rate that is applied to the assessments that would change.
Which ultimately changes the value.
Well, it would...
if you use comps and so on, that's how values are determined. It's not simply what the value is on your tax statement as to what the value of the land is. So... If all of those ingredients go in to determine what the tax rate is, that ultimately determines the value of the land and the improvements.
Maybe I'll defer to my colleague here, Tom Gehring.
You mean now?
Mm-hmm. Would you like?
Did you want to? You were actually number three. Do you want to try and jump in? It's just like landing on the beach, you know.
Yeah. let's do that. Do you mind if we do that a little bit later? Because here it's a little complicated.
Okay, well, let's take us through the stepwise. We'll come back to that. Another question, whether you answer it now or later, I'll let you. Mr. Nelson, you mentioned that Pittsburgh had this for 100 years until 2 years ago. That, what happened 2 years ago and why?
Well, that's also a rather complex story, but perhaps suffices to say that there were political elements in the city that decided that it was not functioning as well as other tax proposals, and as far as I know, they ended up shifting some of their tax base onto other forms of taxation, but I'm not familiar with actually how that occurred politically, if what groups were behind that shift.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and let you kind of carry on, and we'll save all of our questions, or else you'll get back to them, and go to Mr. Burkholder.
Good morning. Thanks very much, Chair and members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm Metro Counselor for the northern part of the city of Portland, downtown, northwest, north, and northeast Portland. And coming to you representing the Metro Council actually has taken a position in support of this, mainly because we're looking at the results. And what we're concerned about at Metro is good urban form, orderly development, efficient use of land, and avoiding sprawl into the farmland around the metro area. As you know, Metro controls the urban growth boundary for the Portland metropolitan area. We also have planning on both land use and transportation areas for the city, for the area around the Portland area. And particularly, I think our focus is looking at what role does government have in trying to answer the big challenges that we have right now with the poor economy we're facing. We have 8.6 unemployment, as you're probably very aware. In the Portland area, we have some commercial buildings that are suffering 25 to 40% vacancy rates right now. We're facing a major problem here with the economy. And we're looking at what role does government have here to play. We, of course, look at the land supply. We look at transportation investments. But the other piece is looking at how does our tax structure incent or disincent investment and development. And this, what we've seen in the results of around the country, and again, I'm not a certified smart person on this stuff, so don't ask me questions about urban renewal. But I can say, when I look at other places where they have stabilized housing prices, higher home ownership, increased development in their downtowns and town centers, and taking land that's vacant and reusing it, having rehabilitation of blighted areas, and less sprawl, because developers can find land. Because one aspect, which Chris didn't mention, is that by putting a higher holding cost onto vacant land, by raising the rate that you charge the land, you actually bring more land onto the market. For example, a perfect example is a surface parking lot in downtown Portland. The fact that that land, it has a lot of value for development, but because there's no, the cost of keeping it vacant until you get the price you want someday in the future, because that price is low, that land will stay vacant despite the interest of people to develop it. And what we've seen in the information I've gotten around this state or around this country and around other countries is that we achieve all these goals, which are very consistent with the state land use planning system and with Metro's goals for our area. So that's how I come to you as someone, as a fellow elected official, that says, how do I get a result that I want? How do I get people to invest in their homes? How do I get people to invest in businesses? And how do we get them to do it in a way that supports our goals for land use and transportation? This seems to be a tool that would be very useful to have available. And there's a few other things I think that make it a good policy. One, that's voluntary. You're not mandating a change. You're just giving an option to cities and counties to be able to look at and say, do we think this might work? And they can study it themselves and make a decision. And I think it's a tool that will encourage economic development based on what we've seen here, and obviously that's something we need. And it has a proven effectiveness as that tool. So that's coming to you to say, let's put this out there as a tool to be used by local communities as a way to answer some of the problems they have right now in terms of economic development in their areas. And I can't answer any of those questions for certified smart people, but if you have questions about Metro and its goals, I can answer those. Thanks.
Representative Scott.
Metro is interested in this because of the positive experience of other states who have adopted this policy. What are they?
There are cities in Virginia, cities in Pennsylvania. I think there's 16 cities in Pennsylvania that have it. 20 now? Okay. Not counting Pittsburgh because they gave it up. I think there's New York, not New York City itself, but parts of New York. And I can't go into the list much farther than that. That's the ones I know.
Thank you. Follow up, please?
Yes.
In Metro's boundaries, mentioned that you're interested in it to reduce, and I think you mentioned something about in the Portland Metro area, vacancies are 25% to 40%. How will this help the vacancies?
What we're looking, I was looking, using it as a measure of the current economic crisis that we have in the area, and that having tools available, such as this one, that have seemed to, in other places, encourage economic activity, that this would assist that in terms of just a general rise in the economic activity level. There's other statistics about the economy, if you want other statistics. These are just two things that I pointed out. One is the unemployment rate. The other one is the vacancy rate that we see in some parts of the region, especially in the western Washington County areas is where we see the highest rates right now.
All right. Let's get to Mr. Gearing, who has some of the technical stuff that we... I want to hear about the study.
All right, and I won't get too very technical. My name is Tom Gearing, a planning consultant based in Seattle. I might just answer that urban renewal question if it's burning. But actually, there's no difference in the way taxes are applied under two-rate system in an urban renewal district than from any other part of a jurisdiction. It's uniformly applied. There's just no difference. Now, the only difference is the incentives that are created in an urban renewal district, which would be to encourage development and capital investment in property within the urban renewal. It would just kickstart development. But the application of the tax would be uniformly applied throughout the jurisdiction, regardless of boundaries of urban renewal. That's all. I just want to introduce this Salem study. Was conducted in conjunction with a conference of international land value taxation on international land value taxation that was held in Oregon in 1998. The purpose of the study is twofold. Is first to examine the distortions in the conventional tax burden that are caused by skewed assessments under the Measure 5 and Measure 50, a combination of those over a period of years. And also to examine the tax burden shifts that would accompany a change back to real market assessments from taxable value. The second aspect of the study was to look at the tax burden shifts that would occur in a change to a land value tax system. So we have a combination of two elements that would encompass tax reform in the state. One, the change back to real market assessments, the abandonment of the distortions that we have built upon ourselves through these tax limitation measures, and the second, the introduction of a two-rate system. The study encompasses all of Salem Metro, and is the data that was provided by the Marion County Assessor's Office, 70,000 tax parcels. All we did in the study was simply take the assessed values, both taxable and real market values, use tax simulations, and looking at the outcomes, determine where tax shifts would occur in the change from one method to another method.
In doing this, do you assume revenue neutrality?
We assume revenue neutrality.
Okay.
In the conversion from the conventional tax to a split rate tax. Yes. And the split rate tax is simply the difference is the tax rate. It's not the assessment. The assessments are real market value assessments. But the tax rate would change so that in our scenarios, we built a range that would simulate a phase-in period from 55% of the tax rate being on land, 45% of the rate on improvements, all the way up to 95% of the rate on land and 5% on improvements. Now, that's just the rate, so the assessments remain the same, of course.
Representative Scott.
So if you change the tax rate on bare land so that it becomes improved, the surrounding pieces around that bare land that has a higher rate, would they enjoy or has it have a disincentive of having the equal rate to their improved land that already has a structure on it?
It's hard for me to comprehend. But the...
Well, if you have a block, a city block,
uh-huh.
You have one vacant lot,
yes,
that has no improvements on it.
Right.
And all the rest of the block is improved.
Right.
What's the rate on the land surrounding the vacant lot that is... that does have improvements on it.
Of course, the tax rate is uniform. It's the same. But
so
the
impact... Wouldn't all those folks have an increased rate?
They wouldn't have an increase in rate. They would have an increase in tax burden.
Wouldn't that equate to a rate?
No. The rates are tax rates. They're mill rates. And I'll give you an example. Typical tax on a land would be... let us say for a high, very high differential tax, let us say it would be $80 per thousand on land and $5 on improvements per thousand.
Yeah.
Now that's uniformly applied, but when you apply that to the effect is going to be different on different properties. So a vacant parcel will see if through a conversion to a two-rate tax, it's going to see an increase because the tax rate on land is higher, uniformly higher, since there is no improvements. All that's on that land, on that parcel is land, so it's going to be taxed at a higher rate. So the tax will go up on that parcel, but it's still going to be low because the taxes on land without any improvements are just simply low. So it's going to be a marginal, it'll be a significant percentage increase, but dollar-wise, it's not going to change that much.
You know, if I may follow up, I'm just having a hard time understanding that because if you change the rate to incentivize
yeah.
undeveloped land
yeah.
Now become developed.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the surrounding pieces around it already developed, and you reduce the value of the improvements, the rate of the improvements
mm-hmm.
surrounding it,
mm-hmm.
it seems logical to me that you have to increase, all of those folks would experience an increase equal to what the surrounding land is.
The land values would be similar, wouldn't they,
right.
in the whole block?
Right.
The assessments on the land would be about the same if the parcels are about the same size.
Which seems to me would be an increased...
But I guess what would be happening is that the properties that have improvements on them would be paying substantially proportionally less on those improvements.
It's
where you get the incentive then to develop
yeah.
improvements because... You have a lesser burden on the improvements, so that, for instance, in commercial property, improves cash flow if you're
yeah,
if
right,
you're
right.
if you have lease income, or it improves the income producing value of the property, because proportionally you have less tax burden on that improvement. It doesn't, to put a building up doesn't reduce your taxes. You're still going to pay what you're going to pay on the land, and you're still going to pay an increment of tax on the building, but you are paying less on the building, which is where the incentive comes to develop, because you get more value and you don't pay it. Don't pay proportionately more tax.
That's exactly it. I think where the problem in semantics comes is when you're comparing, when you're saying more or less. The comparison has to be between a conventional tax and a two-rate tax. That's where the comparison needs to be made. So on a vacant site, the two-rate tax is going to be more than it would be on a conventional tax. On a fully developed site, the tax amount would be less than it would if it were a conventional tax. But it's not going to be lower than the vacant site. It's still going to be higher than the vacant site because there's a building on it. There's more value in both building and land combined. So you can't compare. You have to compare. You know, you compare the two rate with the conventional. That's what we're doing here.
If you have a, I want to make sure I phrase this right. If you have improved land that has a value currently on just the land, forget the improvements for a second, and you have a vacant piece adjacent to it, they generally are in the same value range.
The land, yes.
Yes. If the vacant site, if this were to be done and the vacant site would have an increased value,
doesn't have an increased value. Value is the same.
Increased rate. Excuse me. I keep increased rate, which in my opinion does affect the value, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt that it doesn't affect the value.
Yes.
But I think it does affect the value.
Yes.
It may not reflect it on the piece of paper.
Over time, it would.
Statement,
yes.
But it does affect the value.
Mm-hmm.
And your adjoining property that is has been developed prior to the enact of this, unless you have a proportionate and a highly proportionate decrease in the improvement value, you will have an increase in taxes.
Compared to conventional?
Compared to conventional.
No, actually, you wouldn't. I'd have to. It might help to look at the report. There are some graphs in the report that.
Yeah, we have the summary. We don't have the report itself.
Right. The summary does not include graphs or charts or.
And I'm thinking,
table,
you know, I'm getting a sense that.
I have a copy of the. And it's you can look at a graph. And actually, if you work it out, you'll see that the tax on the buildings goes down far enough. The tax on land, because land usually comprises about 30% of the assessment. So on a developed site, you're talking mostly building anyway, but in terms of the value. So there's still a tax, but it's the tax compared to a conventional tax will decrease because most of the values in the building and the tax rate on a split rate is low on the building, it will be a lower tax burden than it would be on the conventional, because conventional is remember the whole site is taxing 70% of that site is in buildings. That's a high rate.
I guess we need to see the graph because
it
still seems logical to me that if you increase the land and you decrease the improvement value
rate
mm-hmm.
which does equate to the value no matter which way we say it equates to the value. If you decrease the rate mm-hmm. and you don't do it proportionately, you're going to have an increase in overall tax burden.
What would be helpful at some point here, not now because we don't have it, but would be to see
a property tax statement,
yeah,
or a couple of
temporary
property tax statements under residential, industrial, commercial, under conventional, and then under some form of a phased-in split rate system, so we can actually see what it looks like.
In the evaluation,
we need to look at
in the Chapter 7 evaluation, you'll see an example of a typical single-family house, and what how the tax falls out on that.
This is like talking about cheeseburgers. We want to eat the dorm.
But it does it do the same thing on commercial and industrial.
Yeah.
Example, you said it does on residential. Does it do
the same thing? And everything depends upon the assessments. The split rate is the same for every property. It's two rates, but it's uniform. I think that's very important.
And there's nothing in this measure that dictates what rates a local and jurisdiction would apply. That would be up to each
local. It's up to the jurisdiction.
Whether it go 45, 55, or 97, 3, or anything like that, that would be entirely up to each local taxing district in its.
Right. Chris brought up the fact of Pittsburgh, and that's I think they were about 75 to 25 but on certain taxes, local taxes. But actually, in doing these simulations, it comes down to a judgment call. But my judgment on this is that the real effects, the incentive effects, really take place at about 75 to 80%. Of a land value tax rate. That's where the impact really takes place. In Salem. Now, again, Salem may not be representative of other jurisdictions because there are some assessments in Salem that appear to be different than what we might expect. And the thing about a two-rate tax is that an assessment on one class of property, such as industrial, will greatly affect the outcome of tax burden in all other classes of property. So if, for instance, industrial sites are undervalued, it's going to affect the outcome on residential and other classes of property. In other words, it will be higher than they really should. So the assessment, it's important that the assessments be accurate and true market value and not reflect enterprise zones or something, you know, that gives an assessment break. So assessments must be true market value for this to work properly. But at any rate, the outcomes were they're all there's statistical tables that go on and on and on. But the basic effect of this tax limitations that we've seen over 8-year period when this study was done show that there has been a gap in revenue and assessments. The assessments under the taxable are about 26% lower than they would be under real market value, resulting in a annual shortfall of about $32 million. That's because of the tax limitations that have been built up. But aside from that, the tax limitations have also produced distortions in the assessments resulting in shifts in taxes onto some properties and off of other properties. And the general results are that the vast majority of properties would see a decrease in taxes accompanying a change back to real market value. It's only a few properties that benefit from taxable assessments and the application of these tax limitations, and those include primarily industrial sites and land extensive users such as farms, homesteads, and vacant land. And what this means is that the owners of property in the downtown area of Salem, if they have developed sites, are paying more than they would if the assessments were true market value. It's the owners of substantial real estate investments that are losing as a result of the taxable assessments. Now, that's not to talk about the two-rate tax. The two-rate tax if that is introduced, in some cases reinforces the same trend. That is, the more intensively a site is built, the more likely the tax burden will be lightened in a transition to a two-rate tax. So we found in the study that multifamily class of property is the one class that probably benefits the most from this, because they're typically, especially the buildings on inner city sites as opposed to complexes, which you consume a great deal of land. Where the building are on parcels where there's not a great deal of setback or where there's not a vast amount of parking, you find that the assessments on land are far lower than 30%, which is the average of the total assessment. So anything in the case of Salem where the assessments on land are less than 30% of the total assessment, they'll find a negative tax shift. And those who have more than 30% of the assessment in the land are going to find a change, a positive tax shift. Now, what we found in Salem is that this tax shift appears to be quite moderate. There are only a few cases in which there's a significant tax shift. That is in the range of 120%, 150% change. And that's on vacant sites, and that is on surface parking lots particularly. And to a certain degree, strip malls and this type of commercial development where there are vast amounts of parking surrounding a big box retailer, if you will. Those are the properties that are going to see increases in taxes under the two-rate system. But developers of intensive use of where there's intensive use of land will see a decrease. It's intuitive, and it works, and it's consistent with this findings that I've done in other studies, such as Vancouver, Washington. I could like to take questions if you can.
Yeah, Representative.
I want to thank Councillor Burkholder and these gentlemen, as well as you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dingfelder, for bringing this bill forward. And I do have some technical questions for Representative Dingfelder in just a second. But, having said that, I do want to ask you about surface parking lots and the practical effect of that. I mean, I suppose there is an argument could be advanced that the parking lots are improvements. Take Washington Square, for example, where you have acres and acres of parking lots. And it would be great, I suppose, if everyone took light rail, rode their bike to the mall. But right. The reality is that isn't happening, and it won't happen. Right. So what would be the impact of raising the rate on that land? I mean, are they supposed to build parking garages or develop it? And then if they do, then if people don't go there because there's parking's a hassle, then
there's a simple answer to that question in a way. The biggest impact, where the largest tax shift in terms of dollars, is in central areas where land values are high. Where land values are high, that is where the tax shift really occurs. Now, in outlying areas, in suburban strip malls and in suburban shopping center locations, land values are typically not that high. So the tax shift, while it is still positive on those sites, is not going to be that heavy. It's not going to be that, in dollar terms, that great. So the incentive is probably not that high. If people are making money off of parking lots, they're going to pay higher taxes, marginally higher taxes, and take the hit, and they're still going to make money off the parking. But it's in downtown locations where the incentive effects are going to be the greatest. And that's true wherever land value taxation has been applied, whether it's Pittsburgh or all these other towns. It's the central areas land values being high, where the impacts are the greatest, and the incentives actually result in changes in land use. So it's downtown sites, I think, really where this really focuses on the impact.
If I may just kind of add into that, I think that Mark, that's, or Representative Haas, sorry, is actually very much in line with what Metro would like to see happen. Actually, Washington Square has been declared a regional center by the Washington County, has wanted it to develop into a more downtown-like feel. I think the conversion of surface parking to structured parking, like at the Lloyd Center, which is almost all structured parking now, in a very small footprint, accommodates many thousands of cars, because it financially made sense, economically made sense to do that. And I believe this would be a mild incentive to keep going that direction in a place like Washington Square, not as strong as some people might like, but the idea of converting...
You would like everybody to ride their bike to Washington.
Oh, yeah, everybody should ride their bike to Washington Square. My background is I was a bicycle activist for a long time, so that's kind of an in-joke there. But I think that as it develops over time, it will fill in, and probably structured parking will become more common. There's some there already at Lincoln Center. I think that, but you'll see that land being used for offices, residential uses, and other things. This would just be a nice little poke, a prod along the way. But I think it's definitely in line with the goals of that area that they've adopted and what they'd like to see happen as well.
Representative Scott, you have a question.
Thank you. You mentioned the value of lands, and so it becomes a variable as to what's considered high and what's not considered high, as to using your remarks as to high-valued land. What happens to industrial sites? You know, in the process of building and through the planning department, there are requirements for parking spaces, whether they be bicycle parking spaces or whether they be automobile parking spaces, which takes up land. If you have a manufacturing company, use large ones or use small ones that require parking for their employees, I guess you're advocating that we build a high-rise for that. What happens to lumber yards or any other storage company that has needs of land to store their product on?
I'll do a quick answer to that in terms of the incentives that this two-rate system creates. What would the incentives would create in this case is that lumber yards are legitimate land uses, but lumber yards are going to find it very costly to remain in central locations where there's demand for building higher density. Because land value is high, it's going to be, it's a land extensive use, they're going to find it more to their advantage to locate in a more distant or outlying area.
Yeah. Which then would be used for developing office spaces and so on.
Would free the land up in central locations for more intensive uses.
Which supply and demand dictates as to how much of that you need, which right. In our case currently would increase occupancy rates rather than decrease occupancy rates.
Or vacancy?
Yeah. Either way.
Yeah.
Well, I think another factor, too, is remember that the zoning that's put on by the local jurisdiction will affect the value of that land, too. That land will remain at a lower value than land zone commercial. And those are decisions that would not be affected by this, the zoning there, because we do have, especially in the Portland metropolitan area, we have protections, specific protections for industrial land, because we do want to maintain that land in that use. Even though there's a lot of demand for it for commercial uses, we've adopted restrictions to make sure it stays as industrial use to protect that job base. And so this, when it jumped this into another category, when it changed the zoning by doing something like this.
Representative Bridget?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I presume that there is an incentive here to change behavior. Is that wrong? Is that an assumption that I've made?
You can say investment behavior, yes.
Investment behavior. Is it also an incentive for me to have a house with a very small yard? Or
yes. look, put it this way. What we see in the Portland metro area is that lot sizes are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The average lot size now is below 4,000 square feet. But it's not because of two-rate taxation. It's because the cost of land is so high that that builders find it unprofitable to build on large sites in central locations, especially. So the two-rate tax simply encourages this same type of market activity that's already occurring to use sites more effectively, more intensively.
Follow up, please.
You're in charge. You got the gavel.
All right.
As much as you want.
There you go.
Chair.
Boy, I'll tell you, I've got a list here. My question is for Mr. Burkholder. You mentioned commercial vacancy rates being so high. And I'd like for you to make the connection for me with this, because for a decade you had a tremendous economy, and you still had vacancy, probably not as high. However, let's say that people start selling off their parking lots because you're going to tax them more, and developers can come in and build more retail outlets. So what happens with your vacancy rate in the central part? They move to closer to Washington Square. How do you see that as really economic development in an urban area?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I was using this vacancy rate just as an indicator of the economic hard times that we have. And when you look at, if you do look at the vacancy rates in the Portland metropolitan area, these high rates are out in the Washington Square, I guess you call it the Silicon Forest area, where there was a large building of offices to meet an anticipated need in the future based on the growth that was happening in the 1990s. The vacancy rates actually in the central city are much lower, but they're still high and higher than we'd like to see them. The connection with this bill and this idea is this sense that if we can do something that encourages investment, period, that it will make the economy work better and therefore address both the vacancy rate, the unemployment rate, all the various negative aspects there. And this is, again, I'm not tying a direct connection between this vacancy rate and this bill. It's more the poor economy, and this is a sign of the poor economy. And maybe I could use another measure, because I'm not trying to make a connection between those office spaces that are vacant and this bill directly. It's more the fact that the economy's down, and what can we do to get the economy going again?
Okay, a follow-up, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Maybe I need you to define development for me. By development, are you talking about real estate development where people are building more buildings? Because economic development is in providing jobs, not just building mm-hmm. buildings.
Well, I think we're also looking at, well, industrial space. We have industrial areas, particularly along the lower Willamette River on the Portland Harbor, areas, a lot of vacant space sitting there. And some of it has some issues, the brownfields issues. Some of that's been cleaned up, though. McCormick Baxter has been the subject of many millions of dollars, and it's cleaned up, ready to go. The question is just sitting there. Why isn't it on the market? The owner of it is not interested in selling at a price that anyone can afford in that area for industrial development. And part of it is because their carrying cost of that land is low. And so I think even in industrial development, how do you get land available? And as we've just gone through a long process of looking for new industrial land in the Portland metropolitan area, and part of that is studying what's out there. And there is a lot of industrial land that's vacant in the Portland area. It is not, quote, available because it's not either on the market, because they don't feel like they can get a high enough value for or a high enough price for the land that they think they should get, or because they choose not to sell because they're land banking for some future need. And the question is, do we want to take farms, which are in industrial use, growing crops, and convert that into industrial land when there's actually land available that's closer to transportation, that's closer to people's homes, but it's sitting there idle? Because, you know, maybe this would help get this on the market as industrial land for employment if their carrying costs were a little bit higher for that. So I think the same concept, whether it's commercial land or industrial land, this has the potential. And again, what it is get the tool out there and let the counties and cities look at it and do the analysis like was done with Salem here, check these numbers for Salem, check the numbers for your own town, does it make sense? Do you think you'll get greater economic activity getting that land into use versus sitting there vacant waiting for a high price to someday come along? Because I think it distorts our land use planning system when we have to go out because that land's not available and Applied Materials comes to us and say there's no land in the urban growth boundary. And we know there's hundreds of acres, but it's not on the market. They can't buy it. And we brought in land 200 acres north of the Hillsboro for industrial use just for that purpose because they can't find that land. So how do we free this stuff up? Maybe this will help. And that's a question that we can't ask unless the cities and counties have the opportunity to actually make this shift or to examine the shift.
You may.
I'd like to go back to you and ask you where businesses are required to have a fairly good size property in order to function as a business. You immediately make a tax shift now onto the property, which gets an increased taxation. Did I understand you to say that that increase would be marginal?
It all depends on the assessment. We found that in Salem, for whatever reason, industrial land is assessed at a rather low level, in which case the results from the tax simulations came out that there's hardly any tax shift at all. But that's because the values are low on those industrial sites. Everything depends on what the assessed values are.
Okay, we're running up against the end of the time that I want to do a lot to this, so my inclination is to close the public hearing. I think what we'd like to do is what we need to do, obviously, to take a look at this again, would be to have some concrete, if you'll pardon the pun, mm-hmm. examples that would show us, I think, some of these differences in existing properties, so we can kind of get a sense of what the impact of this might be. And one last thing, this talks about taxing districts. I assume we're generally speaking of cities, isn't that right? I mean, it wouldn't make much sense to do this for Polk County to do this where it's mostly farm and timberland. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to do that. We're talking about urban areas that would be the...
There are significant areas that are unincorporated counties that are urbanized as well. Clackamas yeah. County, Washington County, yeah. So yeah. They should have the tool as well.
Okay. No, I'm just interested in who's most likely to use this. When you talked about Pennsylvania, you referred to cities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I could just perhaps
clarify part of that. Where assessments are done based on current use, there would be no impact.
Yeah.
So you're correct.
Okay. All right. I want to thank everybody for your testimony today. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 30. And I see Representative Butler. Wait, where'd he go? There he is, in the room, and he is here on which one?
3466.
Thank you. 34. There we are. 3466.
2951.
And 2951. Which do you want to start? Which one do you want to start with?
2951 is fine.
All right. We'll open a public hearing then on House Bill 2951. Representative Butler, or Steve, if you could give us the quick overview while he's getting his papers ready.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2951 deals with school districts and what school district is the resident school district for students.
Can I give you a couple of
things? It deletes some provisions. Basically, it goes to a system where the school district that is providing the education services is considered the resident school district, whether the parent or guardian lives in that district or not. It repeals a statute that deals with contracts between school districts for non-residents, and it also repeals a statute that deals with the residency for disabled students. So it by removing those various provisions and some other language in the statutes, it basically says that the resident district is where the student is receiving the service.
Home is where the service is. Yes. Is that the old song?
Home,
and that's the district then that receives the state school fund dollars.
All right. Representative Butler, welcome back to Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committees. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. And this bill, 2951, to make certain that the money stays where the student gets his education was brought to me by Superintendent Savage. Superintendent Savage is actually from this Oregon. We have some schools that under the what we call our Harper School Bill from last session, which allows superintendents to and small rural counties to float around and after they've retired to actually help. And so Superintendent Savage is the superintendent, and I guess you could call him the dorm father, out at the Huntington, or let's see, no, he's at the Harper School, which is a boarding school, and what he does is he goes out, still lives in Nessa, and then he goes out for the 3 days or so a week. I believe it's just a 4-day school, and what happens is that the issue of where the student is receiving the education is where the dollar should flow. And that seems to be, and I don't know what testimony there will be in opposition to this, and what
Bob Seaworth from the Department of Education.
Okay, and I assume that then that they'll have their ideas as to why this shouldn't or should work. But the concern was that we've got, and particularly in these small districts, these students that need to float from one district to another because of the long distances. I have that in both Harney County as well as Mount Hiera County, as the folks move from one school district to another to receive their education. So, and again, it's many times based upon the fact that I do have a couple of boarding schools in my district, and one in Crane and one in Harper, and these schools tend to be able to attract those students from further away, which may be out of that particular school district, but where the folks can send their youngsters in, turning age 14 and getting a special provisional driver's license to go in, they turn their keys in to the dorm dad when they get there, and then they stay that week, are educated there, and so this bill is brought by those folks that would like to just make sure that the money stays where the youngster is and doesn't stay back where the folks are at, where the parents actually come from. And that's what this is all about, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
If I can put this in context of, we don't have any boarding schools. We've got Dallas and Perrydale, and there's parents who prefer to have their students not in the big school but out in the country school, and so they send their kids to Perrydale. Under this bill, then, the state school support dollars would go to Perrydale and would not remain in Dallas. Is that what this is?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. And if it was elective, just based upon where folks felt like the child could get the best education, that maybe should be addressed as versus the elective versus where it's most convenient to send your children, where long distances are involved. And the, not that the long distance or shorter distance, that it might be to or from one school to further out to Perrydale may be a factor in your district and in other districts. But the concern here has not been just for the convenience of selecting the best school. It's been for convenience of being able to make sure that where the boarding schools are involved, sometimes we're dealing with distances of 125 to 140 miles one way. And so in those circumstances, we have parents that actually send their youngsters into Crane and up to as far away as Harper. And Harper serves, when I went to school in Vail, there was a choice for the youngsters out in the west portion of the county, out in Juntura, to send their youngsters in by agreement, and they had a contract arrangement. They could send them either to Harper or they could send them to Vail. Well, Vail had a store, and so they would send them to Vail because when they'd come and pick their kids up or drop them off, they could always get some milk when they traveled the 60 or 70 miles that they had to go to drop the kids off to school one day a week, and then they would stay there just bored in that school district.
Well, and in our case, Perrydale would draw a student because Ray Wilkerson is a member of the Perrydale School Board, and they can lend such cachet to the district that they just flock to
Mr. Chairman, I was impressed that there would be so many parents in the metropolis of Dallas who would be worried about the big school and needing to send them out to Perrydale.
It's all a matter of perspective, isn't it?
I'm going to write Perrydale down. If Ray is there, then I need to make sure that my children know about and grandchildren know about Perrydale, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Representative Butler? All right, thank you.
Do you want to
testify? I'm still here while you're here.
Happy to if you would.
Because I know you've got ways and means going on. Okay, let me recess the public hearing on House Bill 2951 then and open a public hearing on House Bill 3466. Who's that?
Elizabeth, I see.
Oh, Thomas, go ahead and give your testimony. We'll come back to the overview. You can explain this as well as anybody.
Mr. Chair, 3466 deals with the transfer of tax credits and selling tax credits for research and development expenses. And I think this we will have some testimony from the Department of Revenue, which I'm very supportive of. They feel like that some of the management of the actual resource of the credit itself is better done by the Department of OECD, the Department of Economic Development. I am very supportive of that, Mr. Chair, and I have also examined the possibility, the potential of a revenue source if credits, if in fact the tax credits are ever used to en masse have reductions of tax credits in order to balance the budget of the spending of the state of Oregon for this biennium, then it's pretty good possibility that those tax credits could come in part a discount anyway, and credits would be transferred with discounts, and I would be certainly amenable to any of those kinds of discussions and amendments, and I have discussed this earlier with Deborah and support the discussion and the decisions relative to who should best decide relative to who manages those credits, and I think she'll have some testimony for you. With that, Mr. Chair, this is part of a larger package, and I am supportive of the concept of the disposition of the credits. This is how we're able to, those companies that who go ahead and have the development, the research and development, but do not have the resource, can't use the credit. And this is a way that they raise more money to continue on with further research and development. So we want to continue to foster that. I think there was an article yesterday in the newspaper by Representative Haas that talked about encouraging research and development in the state of Oregon, and we feel like that this will continue to spur on research and development in the state of Oregon, for those companies who sometimes may not have a great deal of current income coming out of that. So I will be supportive of the testimony, which you'll yet hear from the Department of Revenue.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Butler before he spirits away. All right. Thank you very much.
Great
time. Good to see you. Well, I'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 3466, and we'll go back to the public hearing on House Bill 2951 and invite up Bob Seward. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Seward. I work for the Oregon Department of Education and the Associate Superintendent for Special Education in our office. I'm representing the department today to oppose this bill, particularly because of the concepts aren't worthy of discussion, but because the language of this bill leaves many, many open questions that are unresolved and have some fairly dire consequences for children and parents in this state. Currently, the bill proposes that state school fund distribution follows the student from what we consider now to be the resident district to an attending district, and consider that district, the attending district, the resident district for the purposes of distribution of state school funds. This would include, by the way, the first weight for students, all students in the state of Oregon, and also the second weight for students with disabilities. What is unresolved in this bill is that residency for the purposes of state school funds distribution does not resolve the question about legal responsibility for the services to the students, which really is in 339.115, obligation to enroll, which is the district where the parent and the child reside. So shifting responsibility for the school, for the absolute obligation to serve the child, does not follow the responsibility for distribution of state school funds. For the purposes of IDEA and special education, this is a very important matter about legal responsibilities. The district with the legal responsibilities is the district that stands for complaints and due process hearings. It's the district that's obligated to provide a free, appropriate public education to meet all the federal requirements for special education. So what happens is you bifurcate the process, you bifurcate the dollars away from the legal obligation and put a district that's legally obligated without the dollar resources to ensure that the child has the free, appropriate public education that they're required to provide by law. So I see that is a problem. That's an issue that needs to be discussed in depth, needs to be resolved before we would make this move about bifurcating that system. A second issue I think that needs to be resolved before we would pass this law is the effects on the state school fund distribution formula in general, and particularly around the 11% cap waiver process. Districts that in fact identify additional students above the 11% cap, they would not get the second weight for the 1% at 13, for instance, or 2%, will have additional students. The district next door may have 9%. In fact, then the decision about students attending districts would be a financial decision. Can we get the additional second weight for some kids in this district, but not get those weights for those same students in the resident district? I am opposed to that idea on purely ethical grounds. The decision about what's best for children and what's best for families in terms of their education in the districts that they attend should not be a financial decision. It shouldn't be a decision about whether we transfer kids or not in terms of getting more money for one district or another district. So for those reasons, and there's a number of other issues I think that are of equal importance that this law would lead us to have to ask and have to resolve. And they're difficult, very knotty issues that would possibly unbalance, I think, a fairly delicately balanced process right now concerning residency and state school fund distribution. So with that, I'd answer any questions.
Questions? I have one. I think, in truth, that a lot of districts that have this kind of transfer of students or allow this enrollment of students outside district, Perrydale and Dallas being an example,
right.
Ray, you can help me out here. Don't, by agreement, don't the school fund dollars follow the students by agreement between Dallas and Perrydale? So, in fact, right now that's happening by just agreement between the districts. So
that is correct.
Yeah,
yes.
So I guess my question is, just for my own edification, is there a way to get at some of the very narrow issue of some of these districts that Representative Butler was talking about? Or is it? Do we still have the larger problems even getting at these smaller issues?
Well, I think we have the larger problems. I think right now we have a system in place that allows the dollars to transfer to the attending districts already. It's in the interdistrict transfer agreement. We encourage every school district that enters into these agreements to include the consideration of the dollars that it will take to educate the child, both regular education and special education, and include that in an agreement. So the sending district would include a dollar agreement in that agreement with the receiving district. To some extent, that happens well or it doesn't happen well. You know, you make a good judgment or you don't, and the dollars may not be enough or maybe too many, and so they have to resolve those issues. But the process exists and in fact, is fairly effective across the state.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing unless anybody else is here to testify on 2951. Close the public hearing on that, and let's reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3466. And can we get Lisbeth down here now? Lisbeth?
She's listening.
I know. We need you now. Do we have a Senate sheet on 3466? Anybody?
No.
Okay. Deborah? You want to come on up? you want to tell the committee on the record what you did to your ankle, or call it, under HIPAA, do you want to maintain?
It's only
that's the rule, Mr. Chair.
It's only if she
federal law by asking her.
No, only if she transmits the information to you electronically.
So if she speaks into the microphone, does that count?
Well, it could. That'll be litigated, I'm sure.
Just, Mr. Chair, being very foolish is what I did. A bike riding mishap.
A bike riding mishap. Okay.
It will be fine.
We won't ask you.
You weren't on the way to Washington Square, were you? Everyone is wanting to ride their bikes there these days.
I should have been.
It's the Mecca for bike riding. Yeah, go ahead.
Would you like
we're
me to go ahead,
for,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I spoke with Representative Butler just before the hearing about this bill. House Bill 3466 does have some provisions in it that perhaps the department would not have the expertise to perform very well. I mentioned to him that perhaps economic and community development might be more appropriate, but I haven't had a chance to speak with them, so they could have a different opinion as well. And specifically, it's in lines 22 through the rest of that first page, where we are asked to evaluate the actual or potential scientific and technological viability of a firm, look at whether the principal products or services are sufficiently innovative, whether there would be a significant increase in permanent full-time employment in the state. Those are things that typically we just probably don't have the expertise to do at our department. So I just mentioned that to him.
Okay. Now, Elizabeth?
Yep.
Please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, did you want me to?
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
I wasn't
okay.
listening.
That's all right. Give us your overview on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just so everyone's clear, I haven't read this real clearly. I didn't realize this bill was up today, so I really haven't gone through as far as
well, then in that case, let's just wait until we bring this.
Yeah,
have occasion bring to
bring
this back. And I know we've got the research and development bill, the other research and development bills, and I guess this would be something we could look at to incorporate in those if this is something we wanted to move forward. We don't necessarily need to move this forward as a separate bill. It seems to me if we've got the R&D bills and we want to provide for some selling of the credits, we could incorporate that in the main concept. Right?
Right.
Okay. So, okay, having then accomplished the gaveling in, and for the record, we had another leaflet drop from the Oregon Revenue Coalition on House Bill 3466. That is in the file. And unless anybody else...
Chairman, are they demanding our immediate surrender? Because I'm willing.
Okay, with that then, I will... Unless there anybody else is rushing up to the desk to testify, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3466. And that brings us... Thank you, Elizabeth. We had a nice walk. Got that heart rate up. Got that heart rate up. We'll go to public hearing then on HCR 6. Steve, I'll bet that's you again. Yeah. Representative Scott, do you want to stay where you are, or do you want to go down? You're welcome. Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, members, House Concurrent Resolution 6 basically says that the Legislative Assembly reaffirms its commitment to funding kindergarten through grade 12 first before allocating monies to other needs. So it's basically education first for making appropriations to the state school fund before other appropriations.
All right, Representative Scott, do you want to address your resolution?
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Wayne Scott, Representative, House District 39. House Concurrent Resolution 6 changes no laws, has no fiscal or revenue impact. It does, however, reaffirm the legislative's commitment to public education in Oregon. HCR 6 recognizes that all Oregon children have a right to free, high-quality public education. It recognizes the importance of education in preparing today's children for tomorrow's workforce. It also is an important first step in meaningful education funding reform. The sooner that we start funding public education first, the sooner local schools can determine their funds and create their budgets for the upcoming school year. I think that in limited times of limited resources, it's important that we take that first step and ensure that funding for local schools is top priority and done first in our cycle. Thank you.
All right. Questions? I should ask if anybody else wants to testify on HCR 6. By inclination today, I was hoping we might see somebody from the Ways and Means Committee down here. My inclination today would be to hold off taking action on this. I want to, since this obviously it doesn't have any fiscal impact, but it does have an impact, I guess, on the flow of work through the Ways and Means Committee. I'd talk to Susan, Representative Morgan, perhaps, about this, or one of the co-chairs, and ask them to come down and visit with us. I guess they're probably busy, but what I'd like to do maybe is put this back up and invite them to come down and talk about. I know they've got their own work plan, and I want to make sure that we coordinate with them, or that we're telling them, if we're giving them this priority, that they're at least aware of it. Anybody else? All right. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment, it's timely in that yesterday I heard from one of the school districts in my district, basically troubled by the fact that they're having a very difficult time through their budget process with the "we don't know" and understand that we can't know, but outlining how difficult it is for districts throughout the state to put together their budgets, not knowing the numbers that they need to know.
No question. I think it was in, was it 1995, I think, the I heard tell, it was before my time, that the K-12 budget was out in April.
Mm-hmm.
It was done in April.
Mm-hmm.
And last session, of course, if we kind of try and peer through the fog of everything that occurred, I don't know that the K-12 budget was done, but at least there was agreement and commitment on what the number was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
From almost
right.
the beginning.
Right.
So
that's right.
Everybody knew. I don't remember when we actually passed the budget, but there was no suspense.
Yeah.
Obviously, this time it becomes a little more dicey to identify what that number is going to be. But it is so true that when you've got districts out there, they have to budget on scenarios, basically. Plan A, Plan B, Plan C.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, when they've got staffing decisions that they have to make beginning in as early as March, we put them in a position of having to send layoff notices or non-renewal notices based on worst-case scenarios for fear of getting caught anticipating one number and getting stuck with a lesser. So I think this resolution really does pinpoint the logistical problems that our districts have during session years when we are struggling to come up with numbers that they need to know sooner rather than later.
Sure.
No question.
Mr. Chairman. It also, I think, sort of belies an even deeper underlying problem that I think districts have had since we shifted over in 1990 to being the major provider of the resources from the state side. In the olden days, they could plan over a period of time, recognizing a relatively stable source of income off of property tax that allowed them to build budgets and long-term management scenarios that existed more than for a two-year period of time. And what we've had to do and what they've had to do is get to a point where they really can't develop those long-term plans from an operational standpoint because they're tied to an every two-year cycle where the legislature makes a determination about what that base amount of funding is going to be. And that's in a good case. Obviously, we did our best in 2001 only to find that our best efforts were eroded by a series of events outside our control. That never allowed them, and still I think you could honestly say as they're approaching their June 30 deadline like we are, that still isn't probably very stable in their own minds as to how their 0305, or excuse me, 0103 biennial allocation is actually going to end. And I think it underlies, in my mind, even a more serious problem of none of us would want to build the operations in a district like my district that has a $75 million budget that we would want to have them operating on a two-year planning cycle with no better ability to establish a long-term 10-year operational plan. And I think it this measure is well intended, I think, to plant the flag that we want to get that information to them as a first priority of the legislature. But I also want to underscore that I think we've got some structural problems that even with that isn't really going to give them the long-term planning tool that they need to be able to rely on a stable source of funding.
Well, it's a good comment, and I guess reflecting back on last session, we did give them advance notice, and we held to our word that we would fund at the level that we said that we would fund, and then look what happened.
Yeah.
So even when we did that, you've got forces out there that come in that that make it difficult or make it impossible to live up to budget commitments when you lose revenue, when you've lost revenue. Representative Virgin?
I think there is a difference, however, in saying that you're going to fund it before you fund anything else. Do I think it has top priority? Yes. Do I think it has, does it need a funding stream? Yes. And to me, trying to get long-term funding stream, a designated source of money for schools, is different than saying they're pitted against one another, whether it's health services. I just hate to see our priorities, you know, in competition, and that worries me. I just wish we could come up with a funding source for schools, and that would just be settled. That would be the funding source over the long term.
All right. Any further discussion on this, then? I'll talk to our Ways and Means folks coming down and talking with us about this. With that, then, if there's no further discussion and no further testimony, I'll close the public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 6. And with that, we are adjourned.